Welcome to a very special pre-dead episode. What do we call this? The pre-dead media corner. It's where...
PDMC?
Max and I are going to try this sort of bonus episode thing and see if y'all like it, where we're going to talk about death and morbid things in movies and games and music and, I don't know, just the stuff that we like and consume.
Yeah, which we both consume voraciously. I love watching stuff and listening to stuff and...
Yeah.
I want some outlet to talk about that I don't have to do research on.
Yeah.
But,
give you a little break from the research, and yeah, if previous episodes have been any indication, you already know that we love movies, we love music, uh-huh. We talk about it all the time. So, Max, you recently went to Gateway Film Center? Had it?
Gateway Film Center. Yes.
They recently showed The Thing.
God, it's so good.
Isn't it?
Yeah, it rolls.
Have you seen it before? Was that the...
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember the first time I saw it. I don't remember the first time I saw it, but I watched it recently because we used to do an event, some of my friends and I, and it was called WrestleMania, and we would get together on Monday nights and just watch a Kurt Russell movie.
Oh, yes.
And we would watch, like, Captain Ron and Big Trouble in Little China and yeah. Overboard and, like, all... It was so good. But The Thing is one of my favorites. I was very excited when we hit that point.
Yes. I don't know when I saw it for the first time, but The Thing might rank in, like, my top 10 horror movies of all time.
Oh, it might be top 5 overall for me.
Yeah, it's so good.
Yeah.
It's so well done. How did it compare seeing it in a theater to seeing it, I guess you saw it on a TV screen before
yeah,
that, right?
Yeah. So it was actually really neat because I went with my friend Ian, and it was like a 21 over 21 thing, which I didn't the title didn't ring it. It was like a $21 screening. So, you know, you paid, and Gateway's normally really cheap.
Yeah.
So, you know, you paid $21 and I got my ticket at the box office and they gave me a drink ticket when I got that. So I was like, oh, cool. And I got a beer at the concession stand. I got a Bell's Two Hearted.
Nice.
Which was great. And I walked into the theater and I get into the theater and it's like a 21 seat theater with the big Dream Lounger chairs.
Yeah.
And it's not stadium seated, but they're just projecting the movie on the wall and they have a full bar set up in there. So I was like, ah, fuck, like I should have saved my drink ticket to get like a whiskey ginger or something like that.
Sure.
And then we just did some trivia while we were in there before the screening.
Uh-huh.
And we got more drink tickets.
Nice.
So it was a great experience overall. It's very enjoyable.
Sounds pretty fun.
Yeah, it was great. People got rowdy at the right parts.
Oh, man, that's the best. When you go to see a movie in a theater, especially an old movie that people are familiar with.
Yeah.
Like, I saw Pulp Fiction at Studio 35 a few years ago, and It was fantastic. Because people were laughing hysterically when funny things happened.
Yeah.
They were cheering during certain parts. It was so much fun.
Like, one of my favorite lines in The Thing is when the weed guy, who I don't know if he has a name. I think his name might be Windows.
Yeah, Windows.
Yeah. But he, they're talking about, it's a very, like, of its time moment where they're talking about they know that there's a creature, but they don't know that it's a UFO, or they don't know that it's an alien. And when, like, someone's like, man, is this real? Could there actually be aliens here? And Windows goes, Chariots of the Gods, man. Von Daniken. It's just like, yeah, I guess Eric Von Daniken wrote Chariots of the Gods in the 60s, and that was kind of the height of the craze.
Yeah, but that reference went right over my head.
Yeah, it's a very bizarre, because he delivers it right before the scene cuts. It's really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, real quick, before we get too much deeper into it, we should probably tell whoever's listening to this what the movie is. Basically,
shut this off right now and go watch it.
Well, real quick, before we get to spoiler territory, I'm going to give a very brief description, and we'll talk very briefly about the other movie that is connected to this. Then we'll get to the spoily bits. So, just fair warning, we'll let you know when we start spoiling the shit out of the movie. But yeah, I mean,
81, right?
What's that?
It came out in 81.
82.
Okay.
Yes. I'm of the opinion that if something is spoiled for you and you watch it and it's not good anymore, then it probably wasn't that good to begin with.
Exactly. Yeah.
I think that if, even if you ignore all the warnings and you listen to every second of this episode, you should still watch The Thing. It totally holds up as a horror classic.
Oh, yeah.
And it's so well done.
Yeah.
You should absolutely watch it, regardless of how much
very you creepy. Know. Yeah.
So well done. This is from Wikipedia. Based on the 1938 John W. Campbell novella, Who Goes There? The Thing tells the story of a group of American researchers in Antarctica. Oh, let me try that again. It tells the story of a group of American researchers in Antarctica who encounter the eponymous Thing, a parasitic extraterrestrial life form that assimilates and then imitates other organisms. The group is overcome by paranoia and conflict as they learn that they can no longer trust each other and that any one of them could be the Thing. It stars Kurt Russell, like you said, as the team's helicopter pilot, R.J. McCready, and features an all-star cast including Wilford Brimley, Keith David, and a lot of other guys in supporting roles. I'm not going to read the whole list of names, but great cast.
Yeah.
Very well known.
Yeah.
Have you seen the 1951 film The Thing from Another Planet?
I have not.
So this was
how adjacent are they? Are they?
Well, this is the first adaptation to film of Campbell's novella.
Okay.
And it's, I've seen clips of it. I haven't watched the whole thing. It's very much an old movie. It's action heavy for a real old movie from the 50s.
Okay.
So it's kind of fun.
Yeah.
It's very nationalist by comparison because it
the Thing is a communist.
Yeah, instead of the ending of the John Carpenter film, which we'll get to, it's very like the day is saved by these American researchers working together with armed forces. So it's a very like hurrah America sort of film, which is kind of interesting. But it's surprisingly good from what I've seen.
Yeah.
And from what people tell you. And I think you can watch the whole thing on, I don't know, some streaming service. Okay, we should get into the spoiler stuff. If you're still listening, fair warning, the entire movie is going to probably be ruined for you starting now.
Beep.
So, Max, describe the characters.
So, Kurt Russell McCready is kind of like, he's a little less funny than the role Kurt Russell normally plays.
For sure.
Like, Kurt Russell plays a doofus really well.
Yeah.
Like kind of a... He's kind of like, if you were playing D&D, he would be like a barbarian who kind of rushes in and knocks a bunch of stuff around, but is also kind of a goober.
Yeah, Big Trouble is the most classic example of that.
Yeah. And like Captain Ron, he's really goofy too. But he's very, like, no-nonsense in The Thing. And, like, the whole movie is all dudes, right?
Yeah. Entirely male cast.
Yeah. The only woman is the chess machine that he's playing chess against. There's, like, one line, and it's Adrienne Barbeau, who is Rizzo in Grease. It's just her voice. Yeah, it's really weird.
That's awesome. That's a very short-lived character.
Yeah, because he immediately...
The first death in the film...
He just goes, fuck this, and pours whiskey all over it.
I believe the line is, cheating bitch. So, yeah, the film absolutely does not pass the Bechdel test. You'll have to look at elsewhere for any kind of representation of non-male characters. But, yeah, we still like it.
Well, there's also the toxic masculinity interpretation that you might talk about later.
Well, I didn't have any. We can... This is free form. You can bring up whatever. Yeah. But yeah. Yeah, we'll come back around to like themes and interpretations of the movie. I just love how bored all of the characters are.
Yeah.
And cynical. Where just right from the rip, it's these researchers and McCready, who's basically just the pilot, towing them around.
Gets them in and out.
Yeah. And they're all just bored of sitting in this base doing nothing. To the point that he's, like, the most entertaining thing he can think to do is just destroy a computer.
Yeah.
And
just play chess over and over and over.
Yeah. And, you know, if you have a full-time desk job, you can probably relate to wanting to destroy your computer just to have some kind of entertainment.
Yeah.
Not that I know anything about that. and it's so good because that just cynical boredom turns into total paranoia and distrust of anyone else. And I think that that's one of the biggest strengths of the movie. Like, It's a monster movie. There is a monster, and it is foreboding and terrifying.
It's creepy.
It's incredibly... I mean, we could talk plenty about that, too.
Yeah.
But I love that, at least to me, the chief fear in this movie is distrust. That at the end of the day, it's, you know, this thing is imitating humans and is able to do a pretty compelling job of morphing very violently and slimily into them.
Yeah.
To the point that they don't know who to trust. They don't know how to communicate with each other and problem solve because they just don't like each other and they're cynical of anything getting better. And that tension being paired with the actual like murder machine that is the thing, it brings so much tension to the movie. It's so good.
Yeah. Because the whole thing is, I guess it's tough to talk about this movie because I keep wanting to say thing, but you know, that's
the thing. Yeah. It is the thing.
The monster wants to get out of Antarctica, and it has to figure out a way to do that. But all these dudes at the base are like, we can't let this happen, because there's a scene where, I think it's Wilford Brimley. He's running the numbers, and he figures out that it would take like 17 days for the thing to assimilate all life on Earth if it got exposed to a major city.
Oh, jeez.
It's like, dude.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so well done. We should talk about the monster. So there is a really good video essay that I watched from Film Radar on YouTube.
Uh-huh.
And I think that he had a really good breakdown of it. The movie basically just has a combination, a blend of rational fears and irrational fears. Now, by definition, irrational fears are just fears that we all have of things that we're not really in any kind of immediate danger of.
Yeah.
Like, we all have them. It's not meant to be like a judgment call. Like, if you are afraid of spiders and have arachnophobia, technically speaking, that's an irrational fear.
Most spiders are your friends.
Yeah.
They want to help you.
Even though most of them are, like, poisonous if you eat them, they're not really trying to attack you. They'd rather run away from you.
I'm a huge spider fan.
Yeah. But some people aren't. And that's understandable. But
I don't like birds.
Oh, yeah. You have a big bird phobia, whatever that is. But I love that Film Radar breaks it down where there's these rational fears of specific dangers that they're going through. There's claustrophobia of being in this base. There's isolation. I think it said at one point it takes them like a full day just to like helicopter out to the next...
Yeah, I think it's a day to the Norwegian base, which is the next closest base to them.
Right. By helicopter. So if you take into account the storm that's going on, it's basically impossible. Yeah. There's the harsh climate, you know. The end of the movie is basically like the two characters freezing to death, not being... The threat is no longer really the monster. It's just there's no way they're going to live through this storm.
Yeah.
It's rational fears. And if you think about it, the irrational fears are all manifest in the monster. It kind of triggers at various times arachnophobia.
Yeah.
Fear of dogs, hemophobia, fear of blood.
Uh-huh.
There's a fear of slime. There's a fear of snakes when it's slithering all over. And if you think about it, Film Radar kind of pointed out that it's all of these things are like some of the most common fears that we all have as far as irrational fears go. That's a very common thing to experience.
Huh.
And the brilliance of the monster and the special effects is that all of those things are triggered in turn at like various times.
Yeah, because it takes on different forms.
Exactly.
Like there's the dog monster.
Yep.
There's the mouth monster.
Mm.
There's the head monster.
Isn't there a fear of holes too that's like kind of a thing? That people...
Yeah, I forget what that's called, but that, like, when he's, when the doctor is, like, ripping open the thing's guts...
Oh, no, he's just doing, like, a defibrillator, and he,
Oh, but oh, no, he opens part. It up at one point when they're seeing, like, the half-mutated dog corpses and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's gross. There's, like, holes all over that thing.
Yeah. And there's the defibrillator scene, which is so brilliant, and still... very unsettling to watch to this day, where he goes to like run it and like get the guy's heart starting, and his the corpse's chest opens up.
Yeah, he goes to like shock paddle him and just goes whoop
and bites his hands off. That is, see, I don't know the first time I saw the thing, but I remember seeing that specific scene way too early.
Uh-huh.
Like, as a real little kid.
Yeah.
Because that is one of those scenes that's forever ingrained in my memory as, like, something borderline traumatic. Yeah.
Did you ever go to Double Happiness, the venue that used to be here in Columbus?
Yeah.
Do you remember how they would always show, they would have, like, the thing running on a constant loop?
They would always show TVs the weirdest above the movies bar? Up there, yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
There would be a lot of points where I would be done seeing a band and just be sitting at the bar with a beer and just be watching the scene where they're, like, flamethrowering the big dog mound.
Yeah.
And that's, oh,
so creepy.
Are we going to talk about our least favorite scenes at some point, or can I do that now?
Go ahead.
My least favorite scene is not really one of the monster ones, and I think it's because of some of the mouth stuff that I have issues with.
Yeah.
But it's when they're running through the tunnels under the base, and Wilford Brimley has escaped. And he pins one of the guys up against the wall,
mm-hmm.
and then just reaches into his mouth. Like, he puts his whole hand inside the guy's mouth.
Yes.
And starts, like, expanding his hand. And it's like, you see the monster's fingers start, like, ripping through this guy's gums and face and cheeks. And it's so gross.
You literally just had a genuine shiver. Ugh. Even just describing that.
I mean, just the visual of having a hand jammed in your mouth, and then that hand being opened up all the way and expanding is, ugh.
Yeah, it's vicious. So, on the note of that violence, and whoa, you are so rattled. You're so rattled that you chucked your seltzer.
I did.
You didn't get it on your computer, did you?
I did get it on my computer. I didn't get it on my phone.
All right. Well, hopefully your computer's all right.
Yeah, it's great. Finish it off.
It's just water. On the note of the shocking violence, did you know that The Thing was received very, very poorly by critics and in the box office?
Yeah, people hated it,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, they despised it. It did okay. It basically it broke even, but not much better, which was a huge blow for John Carpenter because he was coming off of Halloween, Escape from New York, and all of these classic movies. He was starting to build up trust.
Yeah.
As, like, almost an auteur filmmaker in Hollywood, and people trusted him with his vision.
Yeah.
Here he comes, adapting his dream story into film, and it was super ambitious. He did, like, a really involved shoot. I think it was on location in Antarctica.
It's Canada, actually.
Okay.
Canada, but they built the whole base.
Yeah. So,
and then they blew the whole base up.
Right. It was the biggest budget movie he made up to that point. I think it was, like, $14 million. Which by today's movie standards is hilariously indie.
Yeah.
But, one critic panned him as a pornographer of violence. And if you read a lot of the negative reviews, they're all basically trashing this movie for the characters are shallow and they're only there as props for the special effects, which admittedly are pretty good. But this is just like a schlocky gore fest.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you have to say to that? Just... You saw it most recently. Does it come across that way to you in any way, shape, or form?
And so, I think at the time, I could see how it would be viewed that way. But especially now, as you get... You know, I think about a movie like No Country for Old Men,
mm-hmm.
where, like, Javier Bardem is blank that whole movie.
Yeah.
And so is...
Josh Brolin?
Josh Brolin, yeah. So is Josh Brolin. Like, they both play pretty expressionless dudes, and people... That's one of the best movies that I've ever seen. It's a great movie.
Yeah.
But there's not a lot of characterization, and I think that's something we're more comfortable with now.
Mm-hmm.
And it would have been harder to swallow back then, but I think that, like... I mean, the effects are great, but there's, like, four distinct points where you really see what's going on.
Yeah.
So it's not like the whole thing is like a big slasher movie. It's not like Scream or anything like that.
Right. Personally, I would kind of argue that there is a fair amount of character development. Maybe not development, but the characters are strong. I think that it doesn't come across quite as like overtly as in some other movies, but there's just little things here and there where you get an indication of just... I think, you know, this is a very like brooding, you know, maybe blank is... one way to put it, but these are definitely kind of brooding,
yeah,
cynical, just grumpy characters.
It's like,
but kind of understandably so.
Yeah, well, it's like when people talk a lot of shit about Catcher in the Rye, yeah, and people go like, well, Catcher in the Rye sucks because Holden Caulfield is just super whiny. But like, I think what Salinger does with that book is he captures what it's actually like to be a brooding kid.
Mm-hmm.
In maybe the best way that we have, you know? And I think in the same way, Carpenter really captures what it's like to be a super macho dude stuck in an Arctic base.
Yeah. And there's moments of softness with some of these characters, too, that I think sneaks in.
Yeah.
It still comes across as almost like a Predator-esque, like, all-male cast dispatching an alien threat where, you know... I don't think that it's quite as ham-fisted and silly as Predator, which I love Predator, but let's be real here. Those are not real characters.
Yeah.
There's a moment where MacReady, like, shit's hitting the fan and people are dying, and he's recording a tape in case nobody makes it out alive. He wants to leave some kind of record. And there's a part where he records something.
One other thing. I think it rips through your clothes when it takes you over. Windows found some shredded long johns, but the name tag was missing. It could be anybody's. Nobody trusts anybody now. We're all very tired. There's nothing else I can do. Just wait.
Yeah, nobody trusts anybody anymore, and we're all tired. And immediately he stops recording and rewinds that, listens back to himself saying that, and decides, nah, I'm gonna re-record that and say,
yeah,
there's nothing else that we can do right now. Just wait and see what happens. And I love that moment because compared to Predator, where everyone has to be macho all of the time, and these are, you know, mid-80s, like, stereotypical he-men that never struggle with anything and have no
Carl weaknesses. Weathers gets his arm shut off or shot off, and it's not like it's he's fine.
Yeah. It's caricature. But these characters are trying to be that way, which I imagine is maybe what a viewer of Predator would want. That, you know, if you're especially a stereotypical male viewer of that movie, you want to be one of those guys. You're like, yeah, fuck yeah, macho. No, like, nothing threatens me. You want to be Arnold.
Yeah.
But what's more realistic is you're a character like MacReady, who you are trying to be the tough guy that you have the reputation of being, but you have these moments where you have to reasonably look at the situation around you and you can't help but falter and feel like there are no options.
Yeah.
This is all for naught.
Yeah.
And the way that he deals with that is literally rewinding it, trying to erase that, like, defeated attitude and just kind of make the decision, you know what, there's nothing else we can do. Which in and of itself is also kind of a, like, hyper-masculine way to deal with it.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the critiques that you see kind of arise, because people go, oh, there's no women, it's just kind of a macho dude movie and it sucks. But the whole thing is, from what I've seen, like, people have critiqued it in, like, a window where it criticizes toxic masculinity, because even though the thing perfectly replicates a person's physical being, it can't replicate a person's brain,
right,
or their knowledge. And so if these dudes would just ask each other, like, a personal question, they would be able to figure it out and they would be able to solve it. But they're so focused on, like, being super paranoid and not letting their own guards down for long enough to get to know somebody.
Yeah.
That they end up all, like, strapped to a bench with flamethrowers pointed at themselves.
Right.
And, like, cutting their hands open and shocking the blood to figure out who has infected blood, instead of, like, genuinely talking to each other.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. And it's funny because, you know, the macho thing to do is what? Is to not show emotion and to deal with the situation.
And that's exactly how you would defeat the thing, how you would figure out who it's taken over, you know?
Sure. But, you know, what an emotionally charged scene, especially at the point where their boss, who they don't trust anymore,
yeah,
Gary, I believe, is tied to the couch, and he's just says, like, I'd appreciate it if I didn't spend all fucking night tied to a couch!
Gentlemen, if you have a moment.
Yes.
Yeah.
Such a good line that I butchered just now, but yeah.
Oh, I forgot about the Venus flytrap monster that shows up in that scene.
Oh, yeah.
He comes out of the couch, and he's got the weird, like, flytrap head, and he just bites onto the dude and just starts whipping him around.
So good. God. So another reason why this was poorly received, or at least one theory of it, June 1982 is when this movie came out. I believe it was like the 24th or something like that.
Okay.
Other movies that were in theaters at the time. Poltergeist.
Cool.
Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan.
Probably cool, I don't know.
E.T.
That's fine, yeah.
Which, if you think about it,
to go this up is, against E.T.
Yeah, this is a couple years after Thatcher and Reagan are elected. The Cold War is moving away from detente, the passive way of like dealing with conflict. Uh-huh. They're moving more into aggressive talks.
Yeah.
The political climate, the world climate is very hostile. And you go to the movies, you're probably more in the market to watch something fun and lighthearted, like
trying to escape,
which blew up. It got widely popular that
year.
Also, Blade Runner came out on the exact same day as The Thing. So that was a great day for movies.
A great day for movie posters. Those are two of the best movie posters of all time.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I think part of it, too, is that people were much more eager for some kind of positive feel-good media in this sort of climate.
That makes sense.
Not something so nihilistic.
Yeah.
And The Thing is very much nihilistic. It's very existential crisis.
Yeah.
It is. And the ending is basically these two guys, again, succumbing not to the monster killing them. They seem to have kind of dealt with the monster, maybe. At the end of the movie, though, it's basically just two guys with nothing left, knowing that they're going to die at the hands of nature. And just kind of...
They're like 4 days away from rescue. The base is burned.
Right. Throughout, MacReady's character is just always dealing with a low-level nihilism of just kind of, does he, he's trying to do the best he can, but it's also like he doesn't really see much hope in any of these situations.
Yeah.
And finally it ends in just kind of, you know, what was this all for?
Yeah.
What do you think about that ending?
I know there was an alternate version of the ending. I like it. I like movies that kind of end like that where it's just bleak. It reminds me a lot of have you seen The Warriors? The Warriors is one of my favorite movies as well.
Yes.
And it has that beautiful ending where after that after the bad guy is killed on the beach by the Riffs, I think is the gang that kills him. And the Warriors, they all walk away, and like, you know, the main guy whose name I forget, I don't even know if he really has a name even.
Swan,
yeah.
Yeah.
But, like, they all walk away at the end, and Swan gets the girl, and, like, everything should be fine. Like, their main rival is dead, and they're back home.
Yeah.
But it's this really beautiful scene where, like, they're walking away, and you know that they've won, but they're going to have scars.
Yeah.
And those that's not going to go away, you know?
Yeah.
And there's, like, this lingering thing where like there's this good facade on the surface, but underneath, you know, it's just like ruined.
Yeah.
And when you see the thing, like, it's like, yeah, they've won, but things are not going to be all right for these two dudes who have made it through.
Yeah.
And like they're dead, you know?
Right. There's consequences for a life that it basically revolves around crime and violence.
Yeah.
That, you know, yeah, you can get revenge and escape a bad situation, but people have already died. And in that movie, the hope of peace was alive with... what was the like the main dude's name giving the speech? Can you count?
Can
suckers?
You dig it?
Cyrus.
Man,
God. I guess we got to do this.
I got to rewatch next. Warriors.
Yeah. Yeah, but Cyrus is dead. The vision of all of the gangs of New York setting their conflict aside is dead.
Yeah.
With him, it's pretty nihilistic. It's pretty like it's pretty bleak.
No, yeah, it's bleak. Like they're never gonna get along again,
right? But yeah, I'm with you there. Though I love movies that just let it end that way.
Yeah, and you don't see Kurt Russell or Tony. What's his name?
Keith David.
Keith David. You don't see Kurt Russell or Keith David die. They're both alive at the end, but you know that they're not going to live.
Right.
Like, but it doesn't give you the closure of seeing them die.
Yeah.
It just ends and you're like, well, these guys are going to die like in 45 minutes.
Right. Dum dum.
Yeah. But you know, it's, I don't know, it's unsettling and it leaves you feeling very unnerved.
For sure.
But
I figured to end this episode, we should go down the rabbit hole with that ending.
Uh-huh.
You hear about the theories with that ending.
I've read them, but I've always been very confused by them.
Okay, so the leading theory is that Keith David's character, Childs, one of the two survivors at the end. Now, Childs and MacReady have been at each other's throats, super suspicious of each other the entire film up to this point. Childs is just gone for the last combat scene where MacReady appears to have killed the thing and it brings some closure.
Yeah.
Then they finally meet up. MacReady's like, where have you been? And Keith David's just basically like, I thought I saw a flash out in the snow. I had to chase it down. Then I came back. What happened? They catch up. They still don't trust each other.
Yeah.
But, you know, MacReady basically gives this line like, we have nothing left to do. We should just wait here and see what happens.
Yeah.
There's a theory that MacReady's suspicions are correct and that Childs was infected by the thing.
Okay.
Even in that scene. And this has been like a hotly debated topic with movie nerds that have no life, like myself, because I've researched this extensively.
Yeah.
One indication of this is you'll notice that during that final scene, they're outside in the cold. You can see Kurt Russell's breath in the cold Antarctica air. You cannot see Keith David's breath.
Oh, interesting.
Childs does not produce any kind of steam from his breath. So that's like the most popular factor there that people kind of latch onto with that theory. Another thing, and this is deep nerd, is that Childs' coat appears to have changed colors. That he was wearing a blue coat up to that point in the movie. And then coming back from running around in
chasing after the doctor.
Yeah, in the wilderness, he has what appears to be a beige coat. So maybe the thing did not do a good job of accurately...
Because it tears through your clothes.
And it tears through the clothes.
You have to get a new jacket, around. Yeah.
Exactly. Now, that could be a lighting issue. I don't think that holds much water. But there is something to that. Blair, I believe Wilford Brimley's character, the point where he is probably infected... You see that he is wearing a different shirt. Before that, he's wearing a yellow shirt with the sleeves rolled up. And later, he's wearing what's kind of like a white long drawn shirt.
Yeah.
And he's destroying the communications.
Yeah.
So, in the narrative, it appears like he's doing that because they want to make sure the thing can't escape.
Yeah. They're trying to protect the mainland.
But you do find out that he's infected, probably at that point, and that there might be an ulterior motive of the thing acting and destroying... you know, their ability to contact the outside world, isolating them, making them easier to kill. But it's notable Blair has a change of clothing that is unexplained. Huh. You know, you don't really change from a rolled up shirt with nothing under it to a long drawn shirt.
Yeah.
You know. But again, it could be the lighting. It's whatever. Here's my favorite theory on Childs being the thing.
Okay. So you do what do you think? Are you going to give me what you personally think before you do this?
I will conclude with what I personally think.
Okay.
So there's a point where, you know, they have this exchange. MacReady laughs, says they should wait there. He hands him a bottle of whiskey. Childs takes a drink.
J&B whiskey or whatever it is.
And then MacReady laughs. Now, you could interpret that to mean he's just laughing at the futility of their situation.
Yeah.
It's one final... thing that he can take some kind of solace in before they die. You could note that he has been using his empty bottles of whiskey for Molotov cocktails throughout the finale of that movie, and that he could possibly have had another Molotov cocktail on him that he hadn't used yet. And to test Childs to see if he was the thing, he handed them a bottle of what was just a bottle of gasoline.
Gasoline, yeah.
Childs drinks it and doesn't seem to comment. Yeah, huh. Comment on it. And McCree laughs because he knows. He's like proven without a shadow of a doubt that this is a person who's infected and impersonating Childs.
Huh. That's interesting.
Yeah. Now, here's the thing. During that scene where MacReady is fighting the thing in the final boss battle.
Yeah.
He uses a lot of Molotov cocktails. But then at one point to get away from it, he does this ridiculous parkour flip.
Yeah.
That would be, like, you watch it in the movie and you're like, why?
Yeah. It's like the only part where the physical action is really outrageous.
Yeah. Just him flexing as an action star.
Yeah.
For some reason, I guess just to entertain me because it worked. But it's not likely that he was carrying a bottle of gasoline in his jacket.
Yeah, that's true.
He probably would have crushed it.
Yeah.
That said, I think that this movie is open to interpretation, and that's part of the beauty of it.
Uh-huh.
I think that it had a very mediocre prequel made in 2011.
Yeah, it was fine.
Great special effects, but very threadbare characters. And I'm with you. Like, just don't touch that ending. And I think there is the ambiguity of, like, you know, there's not much resolution, like you were saying. It's a very, like, kind of nihilistic ending.
Yeah.
But I also love the beauty of just, like, you're not sure. You don't really know.
Yeah.
I love those endings where it leaves you in a position where the viewer kind of has to ponder on that.
It's like to go back to No Country for Old Men, like the coin flip scene.
Yes.
Where you don't know if he kills Josh Brolin's wife or not.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Leave it open. That said, I think Childs was infected.
That's just me. Oh, you do?
See, I just personally feel like, in my heart, just from the gut, no other reason other than just, I feel like that's it.
See, I think it works way better if it turns out that they've actually killed the thing, like they've eradicated it, and yet they're just trapped as two regular humans who will never be able to... Like, the only solace they would possibly have in their final moments would be connecting with another human being.
Yeah.
And yet they are both completely unable to.
Yeah.
Because of their distrust, even though that option is available to them.
Yeah.
I think that's really cool.
And that's fair, because their distrust is at the heart of what makes that movie so tense.
Yeah.
There's one scene, too, where MacReady kills one of the staff members who lunges at him.
Yeah.
He just turns around and instinctively shoots him in the face.
Yeah, the dog trainer.
Yeah. In the scene where they're doing the blood test, MacReady tests the guy's blood.
Uh-huh.
And Childs turns to him and says something snarky, like, looks like he's not the thing. Guess that makes you a murderer, huh? And they just kind of, like, keep doing the test.
Yeah.
And he just tries to steamroll right over that. But... That kind of adds to the tension between those two characters. It's just been going on the entire movie.
Yeah.
The movie finally ends with they are not able to trust each other.
Yeah.
And yeah, how poetic would it be if all along neither of them were ever infected? They just could never trust each other.
Yeah, they just couldn't deal with it.
Because
of
toxic masculinity.
Yeah.
How about that?
Who would have thought?
Well, cool. I'm glad you saw it in theater. I was pretty jealous, but...
Oh, you said Diarrhea Planet.
Yeah, I went to Nashville and saw my favorite band's last show, so I'm only nominally jealous. But, cool. So, did you see the thing? You? Listening to this? Yeah, you?
Are you infected by the movie?
Are you infected? No, we'd love to hear your thoughts on this. Both the movie and just this weird little one-off bonus episode that we're doing right now.
Yeah.
Should we do more? What should we talk about if we do more?
You know, there's a lot of stuff like this where we want to talk about it, but it doesn't really fit the format of the show.
Right.
And we're not big enough yet where we can just go completely off the rails and do whatever we want.
Yeah, and Pre-Dead Boys is never going to be just a Talking Heads episode. We plan on continuing to do research and have it be, you know, a quality 45 minutes to an hour of, like, good content.
Yeah.
But... Yeah, we also love just gabbing about the cool shit that we see. So if you like this, let us know. Email us, predeadboys@gmail.com. You can talk to us on Twitter or Instagram @predeadboys. And we got a Facebook group. Just search Pre-Dead Boys Podcast. Let us know what you think.
Yeah, we appreciate y'all for supporting the show in whatever way it takes for you to unlock this content. We haven't decided that as we're recording.
Yeah, we might blast the first one up for free, and then yeah, you know, if there's something else we want to do, I don't know. Give us your feedback, please. We don't know what we're doing. Thanks for listening. We'll see you guys later.
Yeah, see ya.